This module is a presentation about mood disorders that occur following traumatic brain injury. Mood disorders are a group of psychiatric diagnoses where a disturbance of mood is the predominant symptom. Depression can be a feeling state, a symptom of an illness, and a syndrome in its own right. The purpose of this module is to describe the incidence of depressive disorders following traumatic brain injury, to provide a characterisation of the nature of depressive disorder following brain injury, and then to discuss the management of people with depressive illnesses following traumatic brain injury. There are a number of types of mood disorders that can be diagnosed following a traumatic brain injury. I'd like to refer people to the DSM-IV, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the fourth edition, as these are the diagnoses that can be found in that manual. They are also the diagnoses of mood disorders that can occur following a brain injury. The first diagnosis is that of a major depressive disorder. Dysthymic disorders also arise, but they are less severe characterisation of a disturbance of mood than that seen in a major depression. In bipolar disorders, there can be a depressed phase, and there is a bipolar type 1 and type 2. The distinguishing between type 1 and type 2 depends on the characterisation of the manic symptoms. Finally, there are things such as an adjustment disorder with depressed mood and also a depressive disorder following a traumatic brain injury. It's important to be able to distinguish what the relationship of the mood disorder is to the brain injury, in that people may develop mood disorders very shortly after the brain injury, and it is highly likely that the actual damage to the brain and the chemical changes that occur are implicated in the causing the mood disorder. In this situation, we would use the diagnosis of a depressive disorder following closed head injury or depressive disorder following brain injury as the diagnosis. If a person develops a mood disorder following a brain injury 2 or 3 years later, and the relationship with the actual structural injury of the brain is distant, you're more likely to make the diagnosis of a major depressive disorder. There are a number of other psychiatric diagnoses that can also include predominant depressed mood, but the diagnoses are different, and in this case the management is also quite different. The diagnostic groups that can have significant depressive symptomatology includes that of delirium, where the person is very quiet and withdrawn, dementia, where the predominant disturbance is that of cognitive functioning, but they also may be very depressed and withdrawn. In schizophrenia, people can have significant depressive symptoms in the prodrome, the period of time before the onset of the acute psychotic symptoms, and they can also have a depressive illness subsequent to the acute psychosis. Finally, in obsessive compulsive disorders and the post-traumatic stress disorders, depressed mood can be a component or a feature of these diagnoses. It's important to make the appropriate diagnosis because the management strategies can differ quite substantially, for example, with that of a major depressive disorder and a delirium. Why do people get depressive disorders following a traumatic brain injury? Well, there are a number of etiological theories to explain the occurrence of mood disorders following any major life event, but also that of traumatic brain injury. One of the earliest theories regarding why a person might develop a mood disorder is the psychodynamic theories. The psychodynamic theories were proposed initially by Freud and have been expanded upon in modern times. The predominant underlying tenet for the psychodynamic explanation for a mood disorder is that the person experienced some significant loss in their childhood or developmental period, that that loss is unresolved, and when they have a brain injury, that this triggers the unresolved loss and they have a propensity to become depressed. The next major theory regarding why people become depressed is that of the theory of learned helplessness, and Siegelman was the key proponent of this theory. He put forward the idea that people learn that they are unable to change a situation, they feel vulnerable and helpless to alter or change the circumstances they find themselves in, and they become withdrawn, and we characterise that as a depressive illness. The cognitive theories of depression are those that have now acquired a great deal of acceptance within the community, and there is an entire treatment modality focused on the cognitive theories of depressive illness. The cognitive theory was first proposed by Beck, and in it he put forward that people have a particular thinking style, that they characterise their world in a particular way, and that when a negative event occurs to them, because of their thinking style and interpretation of events, that they develop a pattern of behaviour and an expression of ideas that is characteristic of what we see with depression. And Beck put forward that people who have a particular thinking style, when a catastrophic event occurs to them, that thinking style predisposes them to developing a depressed mood. The fourth type of theory regarding mood disorders is that of the biological or physiological theories. The biological theories really gained a great deal of popularity in the 1990s. It was considered the decade of the brain, and a great deal of research was conducted in a variety of psychiatric illnesses, and in particular with depressive illnesses. What has been put forward is that mood disorders, and particular depressive disorders, occur as a consequence of changes in the absolute or relative amounts of chemicals that cause that regulate and control mood. People might have a genetic vulnerability to the development of this chemical imbalance, but that predominantly there are regions of specialisation of the brain that control and regulate mood, and that there are imbalances in the chemicals in these regions that cause mood disorders. The final theory, and the one that probably incorporates all the areas that I've described, is that of the contemporary model of mood disorders. In the contemporary model, it's hypothesised that the traumatic brain injury is a stressful event to the organism, and that that stressful event induces chemical changes within the body, but in the brain in particular. The hypothalamic pituitary axis is the predominant area where this chemical change occurs, and it is ultimately an excretion of increased quantities of cortisol. This changes the functioning of various regions of the brain. It also causes an either relative or absolute change in the neurotransmitters that are important for the regulation of mood. Some people will perceive the traumatic brain injury as being more stressful than others because of their experiences in childhood or their cognitive style. And this influences the amount of stress that they will experience when they have the traumatic brain injury. And finally, the contemporary model acknowledges that there are certain regions of the brain that are specialised in regulation of emotion and, in particular, mood. Part of the theories regarding mood disorders and the control of mood relates to a series of chemical systems within the brain. There are two key neurotransmitters that are implicated in mood disorders. We know that the various antidepressants we use alter the levels of these chemicals within the brain. And one of the key systems for the regulation of mood is that of the serotonin system. Serotonin is found quite widely throughout the brain, but there are certain regional pathways where the serotonin is concentrated, or the nerves that produce serotonin are more concentrated. What I'd like to do is move back to the model of the brain and for us to look at the model of the brain so that we can understand where these regions of serotonin are concentrated, so that if you have a patient that has a mood disorder in response to a brain injury, or you have someone who has a brain injury and you're wondering if they're at risk for a mood disorder, if you think about the regions of the brain that have been damaged in that person with reference to the anatomical model and the distribution of the pathways. Now, in the brain, we have the frontal regions, the parietal and the temporal areas. And in my hand, I have a model of the brain. This is the right side of the brain, part of this model. And what I want to point out is the brainstem area. This area is called the medulla. And then we go up into the midbrain, and we have the frontal cortex. And on the other side and deep down, we have the temporal region. Particularly important for the serotonin system is the midbrain area. We have a number of nuclei that produce serotonin, and they communicate to the front, in particular the dorsolateral area of the frontal region. They project up to the basal ganglia and to the structures deep in the temporal area here called the amygdala, and the hippocampal area located above here, above the hypothalamic area, located above the pituitary gland, are also areas where there are rich pathways of serotonin. So they project up through the brain, particularly in the frontal areas and the temporal areas of the brain. The role of serotonin is one of the key neurotransmitters for mood disorders, and it has an intimate relationship with noradrenaline. While the adjustment of noradrenaline itself is not implicated in mood disorders, we know it has a role affecting the serotonin neurotransmitters and the level of serotonin that is produced. The area of the brain that's most important for the serotonin is in the frontal areas of the brain, and that this pathway is most predominantly implicated in the mood disorders. As far as the noradrenergic pathways, which is the next major neurochemical pathway implicated in the mood disorders, the noradrenaline neurones start lower down in the brainstem, in the medulla area, and in a region called the locus coeruleus, and they project throughout the entire brain, but in particular into the frontal areas. They also affect the hippocampal region, which is up here, the thalamus, which is the deep structures in there, and the amygdala, which is deep down in the temporal lobe. And the way serotonin affects people with regards to mood disorders is that if the noradrenaline neurone acts on a presynaptic neurone, it actually decreases the amount of serotonin. And if it acts postsynaptically on a serotonin neurone, it increases the amount of serotonin. So the net effect of noradrenaline is to modulate the amount of serotonin that is available to the brain, and that the serotonin is then used to activate nerve and nerve pathways that are important for the regulation of mood. There are a number of key risk factors as to why a person might develop a mood disorder following a traumatic brain injury. With regards to the functional anatomy, we know that in the brain, that the frontal area, in particular the closer to the frontal pole the traumatic brain injury occurs, and to the dorsolateral area of the frontal region, that this confers a significant risk for the onset of mood disorders, particularly in the left hemisphere. For right frontal brain injury, if there is a mood disorder, there are often a lot of anxiety symptoms that go with it. The other risk factors for the onset of mood disorders following a brain injury is if a person has a positive family history. And one of the big theories about mood disorders now is that people have a propensity to develop the mood disorder, and then they need to have a number of stresses for the mood disorder to occur. These are stresses that increase the expression of the condition. So someone having a family history of mood disorders implies that there may be a genetic vulnerability to developing mood disorders, and then the traumatic brain injury occurs, and that pushes people over from having the risk to actually developing the disorder. So family history is a significant risk factor. One of the other significant risk factors is if a person has had a past history of major depression. If someone has a major depressive disorder, the traumatic brain injury becomes the triggering event, and it causes the emergence of the major depressive disorder subsequently. Often when people have a brain injury, if they develop a psychiatric illness after the brain injury, it tends to be very similar to the psychiatric illness they had before the brain injury, although there may be some modifications in how the symptoms are communicated and what response the person has to treatment. But typically people seem to have the same illness. There are a variety of drug therapies that significantly increase the risk of developing a mood disorder, and the list of drug therapies is actually multiple, and some of the drugs are used very commonly in the acute brain injury period. In particular, there are drugs used to prevent ulceration in the acute period, such as cimetidine, and that has a significant risk of inducing depressive illnesses. Drugs such as dexamethasone and prednisone, which are used to reduce swelling of the brain, may also cause depressive illnesses. Finally, narcotic analgesics, anticonvulsants, are also agents that can cause a depressive illness, and benzodiazepines that may be prescribed to reduce or settle behaviour are also known to cause depressive illnesses. So there are a whole variety of medical therapies that can increase a person's risk to a mood disorder. And finally, the person's going to have a particular coping style or cognitive style, and that can increase their vulnerability to developing a mood disorder. One of the things I want you to imagine when you have a patient who's had a brain injury is that the brain injury, if it's in a particular region of the brain, will increase the risk of developing a mood disorder. But then we add risk factors, and the more risk factors a person has, the more likely they are to go over that threshold and present with a significant clinical illness that requires treatment and longer-term management. So how do we assess a person who has had a traumatic brain injury and we suspect that they may have a mood disorder? There are a variety of assessment tools available, and if you go to the research looking at the incidence of depressive illness, and I'll review that shortly, you'll see that a whole number of diagnostic methods are used over time and with different practitioners. Obviously, a psychiatrist is more than likely going to do a clinical assessment. But one of the key things about doing a clinical assessment in someone who has a mood disorder following a brain injury is that we need to not only do an assessment of the patient themselves, but also to look at their family and any other significant person who may be in that person's life. And the reason I say that is that the patient may not be able to give an adequate history, they may not be able to provide past information, they may not have sufficient memory function or attentional processes to allow the psychiatrist to make an adequate assessment. They may not be able to recall important facts, for example, where the brain injury has been, what parts of the brain have been affected, or how severe the brain injury is. So any other person who can provide that information is vital in the clinical assessment. Carers can be so important in providing information for a clinical assessment. Family members, paid carers, they're with the patient for hours at a time, and they're going to have so much valuable information for the psychiatrist or mental health worker to enable them to make an appropriate assessment as to whether or not a person has a mood disorder. Finally, in some cases, we have patients who don't have any family support. They have such cognitive problems that they can't provide a history. And in that situation, maybe the physiotherapist, the occupational therapist, or any other person involved in the patient's care can provide a longitudinal history of change of behaviour that would raise one to suspect that a mood disorder is occurring. Some of the other techniques or tools that we can use for the assessment of mood disorders include that of structured diagnostic interviews. These are typically reserved for research projects, for epidemiological studies, but they can also assist in making a clinical assessment. And the commonest tool used is the SID, which is based on the DSM-4 and provides a DSM-4 diagnostic criteria and therefore a DSM-4 diagnosis. There's also something called the present state examination, which has a neuropsychiatric section, and again, a ICD-10 diagnosis can be made with this interview schedule. Finally, there are a variety of questionnaires that are either completed by the person or by a significant other that allow for the diagnosis of a mood disorder. In particular, for example, the Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Rating Scale called the MADRS or the Beck Inventory. But there are also components of the MMPI that also allow an assessment of mood and a diagnosis of depression. With the questionnaires, some people would suggest that they're useful only for screening rather than for making a clinical diagnosis. And we know in some of the studies where there has been a comparison between, say, a clinical diagnosis or a structured interview and the Beck, that the incidence of mood disorders is much higher if you use something like the Beck Depression Inventory than if you use a structured clinical interview. But these are a variety of tools available. Almost certainly doing something like the Beck or the MADRS on a person you suspect has a mood disorder, and if they score high, referring them off to a mental health worker is quite an effective way of screening people for mood disorders and attempting to diagnose the illness more accurately. What are the key characteristics of a mood disorder following a brain injury? Well, in fact, it's very similar to a person who hasn't had a brain injury. There aren't a great deal of differences between that of a person with or without an organic lesion, but there is significant overlap with some of the symptoms from a traumatic brain injury and mood disorders. The key feature that should be present is depressed mood. Now, while that may seem quite obvious, in fact, in DSM-4, depressed mood doesn't need to be present. A loss of interest is also one of the criteria, so the person can have depressed mood or loss of interest. But often in the cases of mood disorders following brain injury, it is recommended that the person's complaining of a depressed mood or a significant other is reporting that the person is complaining of depressed mood. Other key characteristics include a change in interest or a level of activity, And often what you see when a person develops a mood disorder following a brain injury is that they were recovering as you would expect a person to recover, and then they stop participating. They no longer make as much effort, they're less interested in what they're doing, and there is a distinctive change, and often there may be a deterioration in their skills base. And as we know, when people have a brain injury, there tends to be a pattern of recovery and then plateauing. But unless they develop another medical problem or something like a dementia, they don't deteriorate. The commonest reason that a person will deteriorate following a brain injury is the development of a psychiatric illness, and in particular a mood disorder. People with mood disorders will complain of problems with memory and attention, and in fact, if you measure it psychometrically, you can actually see those changes on neuropsychometric assessment. So what you're looking for in making an assessment of a mood disorder after a brain injury is a person who's been progressing quite reasonably and then starts to deteriorate or loses interest. There are some very obvious symptoms, and suicidal thoughts and suicidal ideas is a key feature of a mood disturbance. Suicidal ideas rarely occur in the absence of a significant mood disorder. So if you've got someone with a brain injury who's actively talking about suicide, there's a very high probability that they have a major depressive disorder or a depressive disorder following a brain injury. The sleep and appetite changes are less reliable in helping distinguish between a mood disorder or whether or not the person just has the symptoms that one sees following a brain injury. But as the person moves on from their recovery of their brain injury, and we're looking at 2 to 3 years post-injury, the sleep and appetite changes become more relevant in the assessment of a mood disorder. Finally, people who have a depressive illness associated with a brain injury will often talk about being more irritable, and the irritability is often a key component of their mood disorder. So how common is major depression or mood disorders following a brain injury? Now, I need to start by saying that the results vary widely. I can provide you with 100 different epidemiological studies or papers looking at the incidence of mood disorders following brain injury, and every single paper will come up with a different result. And there's a number of reasons why those results are so variable. And the key reasons are due to how the depression is defined, whether they're defining it according to strict diagnostic criteria, whether they're defining it according to a particular score on a rating scale, whether they consider it simply to be a disturbance of mood without any other features associated with a brain associated with a mood disorder. The measurement tool that a person uses will influence the incidence of depressive disorders. For example, some instruments, the threshold for saying that a person is depressed is very low. Others, the threshold is much higher. Sometimes within the instrument itself, you can vary the threshold. For example, with the Beck, you can set a lower threshold and pick up mild, moderate, and severe depression. And so obviously, if one study group is using the lower threshold of Beck, they're going to get a much higher incidence of depressive illness in the patient population they're studying. The time since injury will also influence the incidence of mood disorders. It seems that as people move from the time of injury on, that the incidence of mood disorders increases. What's very interesting is that the incidence is also quite stable over time. So from 12 months to 3 years, the incidence seems to remain fairly much the same. And groups of patients have been studied from 12 months to 3 years, and there is very little variability in the amount of depression that these people are reporting. And finally, one of the most important variables that influences the incidence of mood disorders is that of the patient population that's being studied. In some of the studies, the entry point to the study is that the person's had a brain injury. The severity of brain injury is not the criteria for entry, simply that they've had a brain injury. So this will include people with mild, moderate, and severe brain injuries. Other studies focus at looking at moderate to severe brain injury. If you have a study or a paper that has a broad definition of brain injury, including mild to severe, then the incidence of mood disorders, in fact, is quite high. And this is something that you need to look at when reading and looking at the papers. Now, what I've listed here for you is a whole series of studies looking at the incidence of mood disorders following brain injury. And part of the purpose of showing you this long list is to just give you a sampling of the number of papers that have been published in the past 10 years. And almost certainly this is not a conclusive list. There are a whole number of studies I have left out. A number of these studies are in fact Australian studies. For example, the Douglas and Perlez studies are Australian-based. But you'll see that there is a pattern in terms of the incidence of mood disorders. And that pattern is quite clear when you look at the papers why it has developed as it is. The studies of Silver and Kopanen are community-based studies. So if you look at a study where the patient population is randomly sampled from the community, anyone who's had a brain injury, the incidence of mood disorders is about 10 to 11%. If we then go to clinic populations, and these are the studies by Satz, Bowen, Fedoroff, the incidence goes up to about 24 to 35%. And these are patient populations that are derived from outpatient clinics. So there may be something about someone being at an outpatient clinic that they're seeking help that increases, that means you pick up an increased incidence of mood disorders. And the bottom part of the list of studies going down from Van Riekum down to Lynn, these are effectively very broad studies, including people who've had mild to severe brain injuries, and the criteria and the method of assessing depression has often been a rating scale, whereas the Silver and the SATS studies and the lower incidence ones, they've actually used specific diagnostic criteria or a very structured clinical interview. And that's what I was demonstrating before as to why there might be a variable incidence expressed in papers that are published. And it's got a lot to do with the methodology that's being used to assess the incidence of mood disorders. So we know that mood disorders occur quite frequently following a brain injury. Depending on our threshold of criteria, up to 70% of people who will have sustained a brain injury will develop a mood disorder following their brain injury. What do you do if you have someone who has a mood disorder following a brain injury? This slide suggesting investigations might seem quite strange to a number of people, in particular because often the person will be referred to a mental health service by another medical service. And often what happens is people assume that because someone's coming from a medical service to a specialist service that basic investigations have been done. This slide is really to remind people who are seeing someone who's had a brain injury to think about some basic investigations. People who've had a brain injury can have other medical problems, and in particular they can have disorders of the thyroid gland. In the brain, the pituitary gland is very vulnerable to damage at the time of a significant brain injury. If you damage the pituitary gland, you ultimately end up with a state where your thyroid gland doesn't function very effectively. You have what's called hypothyroidism. This can be very simply measured with a blood test, but one of the classic symptoms of hypothyroidism is depressed mood. So some very basic blood investigations, thyroid function studies are important, but also sodium levels and potassium levels, as the reduction of sodium and the elevation of potassium are associated with depressive symptomatology. A drug level, if the person is on medication, or a drug screen looking for illegal substances and also analgesics, can be a very important part of the initial assessment. When we go on to talk about management, often people with mood disorders in medical conditions are what we call treatment resistant. They don't get well as quickly as we would like them to. And sometimes there can be confounding factors. And in a young population of brain injured people, drug and alcohol use can be a very significant problem. And so doing a basic drug screen when you first see the person might alert you to the fact that the person is using, for example, cannabis, and is not necessarily prepared to disclose that information at the first assessment. But chronic cannabis use can mimic a depressed mood. And so it's very important to screen for that in the early stages. A CT scan should be organised if the person had the brain injury a number of years ago, or if there are any other medical symptoms. For example, if there's been a change in their pattern of movement, their gait, if they're complaining of increased frequency of headaches, visual disturbances, then it's worthwhile doing a CT scan, as hydrocephalus, which is an increased pressure in the brain with a build-up of fluid, is a problem that can occur following brain injury and can also mimic depressed mood. So this is a fairly basic investigation that is reasonably inexpensive. And finally, an EEG, while it's not an absolute essential, should at some stage be done. People with epileptic disorders have an increased incidence of mood disorders, and sometimes it's not until many years following the brain injury that the epilepsy is diagnosed. And we have to remember that there are many variants of epilepsy and that grand mal seizures are, in fact, not the most common form of seizures, and people can have temporal lobe seizures and petit mals and never be diagnosed. And the EEG provides a key to the diagnosis. And because of that intimate relationship between epilepsy and mood disorders, it's important to identify it. Now I'm going to move on to talking about the management of a patient with a mood disorder following a brain injury. And I'm going to talk about it from the perspective of both biological therapies, psychological therapies, and a manipulation of the environment for that person. I don't wish to imply that biological therapies are the only therapies that are effective for people with mood disorders. In fact, any person who has a mood disorder after a brain injury should really have comprehensive management, incorporating all modalities, and sometimes one modality may be more important than another. For example, if you've got someone who's severely depressed, they often can't benefit from cognitive therapy in the early stages, but subsequently when some of the more severe symptoms have gone, then it's reasonable to introduce a cognitive therapy or a behavioural therapy to improve the outcome of that person. The biological therapies, though, are the ones that most people commonly think about for the management of mood disorders. There are a number of problems, though, when talking about biological therapies following brain injury in association with mood disorders. And the major problem is that there's absolutely very little information published about what is effective treatment, how much treatment to use, and what kind of problems might arise. If we look at the studies of effectiveness of antidepressants in the general population, that is people without a brain injury, when you look at the research criteria for those studies, what you actually see is that anyone who's had a mood disorder associated with a neurological problem is excluded from the clinical trials. So we never get any data about the effectiveness of these agents from the initial clinical trials. So a lot of the information about the effectiveness of antidepressants in this patient population is from case studies, open label studies, or simply from clinical experience. Some of the general comments I can make about the various therapies is that often it's worthwhile to start low, because they are more sensitive to side effects, and to slowly increase the dose according to the tolerability of the person that you're treating. It's important to pay attention to the drug interactions. While most people see the modern antidepressants as being very safe and effective, what we have to remember is that there are very significant drug interactions. Most of the modern antidepressants work on an enzyme system or are metabolised in the liver by an enzyme system called the P450 system. Now this P450 system metabolises a lot of other drugs, so if you combine two agents that are being metabolised by the same system, you're going to get drug interactions, you're going to get changes in drug levels, you might increase anticonvulsant levels, or you may decrease them. So it's extremely important to remember the drug interactions. One of the other important things to remember is that patients who have brain injury are often also on pain relief medication. That some of the newer agents that we use, in particular a medication called tramadol, has quite significant serotonin elevating effects, and so you can get a very significant drug interaction without necessarily being aware that this is a potential risk for the patient. Some general principles include trying to keep as simple a dose regime as possible for the patient. Patients with brain injury are often forgetful, they're disorganised, they find it hard to comply with any therapy, and giving them a complex dosing regime for antidepressants often results in a failure of the person to be able to utilise the medication effectively. So keep the regime simple, think of strategies to help the patient to remember to take the medication. For example, if it's a morning medication and they always have a cup of tea of a morning, get them to put the antidepressant next to the kettle, because then they'll see the medication, it'll prompt them to take it. And those kind of simplified dosing regimes improve patients' compliance and ultimately improve their outcome. ECT, or electroconvulsive therapy, is effective, and I'll discuss that in greater detail in later parts of the talk. But one of the most important things to remember about someone with mood symptoms and a traumatic brain injury is if you suspect the person has a depressive illness, it's much safer and it's reasonable to treat rather than say, oh, look, it could just be the fact that they're not very motivated. It's always better to treat because so many patients with a brain injury will have a significant depressive illness that benefits from therapy. So what are the common antidepressants available? You can see that there's a long list of antidepressants that are now available for use in Australia and in our community. And there are, in fact, a few more antidepressants that I've not included on the list, and I'll describe them briefly as well. The first class of antidepressants, and the most widely prescribed in Australia, are that called the serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors. They've been available for about the past 15 years. They're very safe, they're effective. They do initially have quite significant side effects, particularly with regards to nausea and difficulties with vomiting and dizziness. But once the person gets over those initial side effects, the medication's actually very safe and very well tolerated. The SSRI drugs are quite variable in terms of their half-life and their side effect profile. So not each SSRI is the same. And in patients who have a brain injury, some of the longer acting or longer half-life antidepressants, such as fluoxetine, may be of more benefit for the brain injured person because if they forget a tablet every now and then, the blood levels of effective agents are not going to change. The next class of antidepressants are called the serotonin noradrenergic reuptake inhibitors, and they work by affecting both serotonin and noradrenaline in the brain. They're probably more potent than the SSRI drugs, and therefore are often reserved for people who are more severely depressed or those who fail to respond to an SSRI. Side effects are very much like the SSRI drugs. They only last, though, the side effects for the first week or two, and then the symptoms fairly rapidly resolve. They do have a fairly short half-life, and so patients can get quite significant side effects. The next class of drugs are what are called the NASs, or the noradrenergic specific serotonin antidepressant. This is a very new class of antidepressants to Australia. It's only been available for the past 2 years or so. And one of the major differences between this antidepressant and the noradrenergic serotonin reuptake inhibitor is that it tends to be sedating, and it also only acts specifically on one serotonin system, so it has a narrower range of action. Tricyclic antidepressants are those antidepressants that most people would be familiar with. They should be avoided with people who've had a brain injury, particularly because of the side effect profile, and they're actually quite unsafe if they're taken incorrectly. They have a high problem with regards to overdose. They're quite lethal if people take them in overdose or impulsively, and they do interact with alcohol. And so for patients who have a mood disorder and drink, the combination can be quite fatal and undesirable. There is a class of drugs called the noradrenergic reuptake inhibitors. They're a newer agent available in Australia. They've only been available for about the past 12 months. The NRI drugs only act on the noradrenaline system. The side effect profile is actually quite good for people who are head injured, but the major disadvantage for this drug is that it's a twice daily dosing, and so compliance can be a real problem for someone who's had a brain injury. Finally, the reversible monoamine oxidase inhibitors, or REMAs, is actually one of the few classes of antidepressants that has been shown in a randomised controlled trial of someone with a head injury to be effective in the treatment of mood disorders associated with brain injury. So there's good research to show that they are effective. Again, though, it's a twice-daily dosing medication, and there can be problems as far as compliance with this medication in a head injured population. So with all these drugs available, what do you pick when you've got someone who has a mood disorder? I'd usually start with a serotonin selective reuptake inhibitor as my first line agent. And the reason I do this is they're fairly easy to administer, they're once daily dosing, and the side effect profile is fairly good. If you use a medication like citalopram, the potential drug interaction is actually quite low, and the tolerability of citalopram is quite high. So that would normally be my first line of agent. If they fail with the first line of agent, then you'd move on to one of the dual-acting antidepressants, such as the SNRIs or the NASA drugs. And if that then fails, you'd move on to the NRIs or the REMAs. As I said before, tricyclic antidepressants should really be the drug of last choice. The only situation where I would alter that is if someone's got significant chronic neuropathic pain And then the tricyclic antidepressants can actually be quite effective for the management of neuropathic pain. And you might be able to manage two clinical problems with one agent. But it really should be the drug of last choice for a fairly simple depressive illness following a brain injury. What constitutes a failure of the first line of a drug or the first agent? And generally we say that a person has failed a drug if they've had the medication for an adequate period of time, so at least 4 to 6 weeks at one dose and then increasing it to the maximal dose, and that once they've reached a maximal dose and they continue to be symptomatic after 3 months, you would assume that the person has failed in that therapy, and that is when you would switch. One thing to say, though, about people with mood disorders following a brain injury is that they often need higher doses than the maximum recommended amount in the product information, and that you can often go quite safely over that amount just by doing it gently, step by step, and monitoring things such as blood pressure when you're doing it. And it's often quite safe to go above the higher doses. Electroconvulsive therapy, I mentioned this earlier as being an effective treatment for mood disorders. Most people, when they hear the term electroconvulsive therapy, think about One Who Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and that fabulous scene of someone being given unmodified ECT. In Australia, there is no institution that gives unmodified ECT. An ECT is given when the person is under a general anaesthetic and the seizure, in fact, is modified with medication, so you can't actually tell they're having a seizure. ECT is the most effective antidepressant we have. It's far more effective than medication, but we usually reserve it for people who failed medication because of the fact that they need a general anaesthetic and they need to be hospitalised. ECT has been shown to be effective in the management of mood disorders with people who've had a brain injury. A study by Kant looked at 11 patients who'd had depressive illnesses and a brain injury, and they found that it was an effective treatment and that there were minimal effects on cognitive functioning with the administration of ECT. Any effect that the ECT had on cognition, such as impairment of short-term memory, was only quite transient, and very rapidly the person returned to their pre-ECT level of cognition, and sometimes they actually had better cognitive functioning because their mood disorder had been treated and this was adversely impacting on their cognition. There were no adverse medical events in their study, and Kant and the authors of this study put forward that ECT in fact was a very effective therapy that we should probably think about sooner rather than later when treating people who have severe mood disorders following brain injury. One of the things that people often think is that if you have epilepsy, you can't have ECT. So if you've got someone with a brain injury who has epilepsy, who develops a mood disorder, they can quite safely have ECT, but they'd obviously need to have it in a specialist mood disorders unit. What happens if the antidepressants fail? And this is not an uncommon situation. If we give someone an antidepressant, they often respond to the first line of agents, but only 70% of people will respond. And then as you start changing antidepressants, you get a 70% response rate to the next agent. So you've always got a group of patients who are not going to respond to antidepressants or antidepressants on their own. And that's when we move into the concept of what's called an augmentation strategy. And augmentation strategies are effective in people with head injuries. I can say that based on my own clinical experience, but there are no published studies to support the use of augmentation strategies in mood disorders in association with brain injury. What are the augmentation strategies? Well, the commonest augmentation strategy is that of anticonvulsants. A variety of anticonvulsants, in particular sodium valproate, has shown to be an effective augmenting agent for antidepressants. Lamotrigine is another anticonvulsant that has, in fact, a very strong anti-mood or antidepressant effect. However, with regards to lamotrigine, while it's very effective, the use of lamotrigine as an augmentation strategy is an off-label use, and therefore there are some concerns about the potential for medical practitioners being sued by using off-label use. But if it's introduced cautiously and supervised by a person who's familiar with it, it can be very effective. Almost certainly, you've got someone who's got a mood disorder and epilepsy. Using lamotrigine to control their epilepsy will also give you a very significant antidepressant effect that should be considered. Combined antidepressants is the next augmentation strategy, and this is really an augmentation strategy that should be reserved for being used by a psychiatrist. The combination of two classes of antidepressants can in some situations produce a better effect than one antidepressant on its own. But there are also potential significant adverse events with combining the therapies. And so it'd be my recommendation if you have a patient who's failed first and second line therapy and you're looking at augmentation, that they really be referred to a psychiatrist or to a specialist mood disorders unit for the management. And if someone's considering combined therapies, that it be done by a person who's got experience in this area. Other augmentation strategies include the addition of thyroid hormone and lithium. As I mentioned earlier, abnormalities of thyroid functioning can produce a mood disorder. We also know that patients who have mood disorders seem to be less responsive to the thyroid hormone that their own body is producing. And in some cases, the addition of a very low dose of thyroid hormone in the range of 50 micrograms will actually augment the antidepressant and treat the mood disorder. Lithium has always been recognised as a very effective augmentation strategy for treatment resistance. However, lithium is a drug that needs to be used cautiously in someone who's had a brain injury, because lithium does have a number of cognitive side effects and also has a number of neurological side effects, in particular tremor. It can also cause confusion and ataxia, and its therapeutic range is very narrow. So someone who's got a cognitive impairment, if they become confused and take too much lithium, could get quite ill. So lithium augmentation is really one of these treatments of last resort because of the possible complications associated with using it. Finally, there's the use of stimulants, and while this is not a very popular augmentation strategy in Australia, it's one that's used very extensively, particularly in the United States. And what will often happen is that an antidepressant will be combined with dexamphetamine or methylphenidate, which are the two commonest available stimulants, to improve the effectiveness of the antidepressant. What's very interesting about mood disorders is that people often with head injuries have a situation where they're quite apathetic. And we know that apathy is caused by damage to particularly the frontal areas of the brain, where the normal reward systems no longer seem to be working. And the stimulants increase the amount of dopamine in the frontal areas of the brain, and dopamine is very important for reward. So you can get quite a number of very interesting effects by adding stimulants to antidepressants, but in the case of treatment resistance, it really is a strategy that should probably be utilised more often than it presently is. What about the cognitive therapies? There are a number of studies available, particularly in organic-based populations, and the most work's been done, in fact, in people with post-stroke depression, that the cognitive behaviour therapies are very effective for this patient population. But we need to make some modifications. You're going to do cognitive behaviour therapy either in a group setting or an individual setting for mood disorders following a brain injury. You need to modify the therapy. You probably need to break it down in smaller steps. You need to give the people notes about what you've said, and the homework needs to be fairly structured. With the homework task, you also often need to get someone else, either a carer or family member, to also understand what the homework is about, so that they can actually rehearse and practice the homework with the person when they're no longer in the clinical treatment setting. With these modifications, cognitive behaviour therapy is a very effective therapy, particularly for the milder and moderate forms of depressive illness. And we also know that using cognitive behaviour therapy prevents the recurrence or reduces the relapse rate of mood disorders. And so it's got a very important place in the management of mood disorders following brain injury. Psychotherapy can also be effective in mood disorders in association with brain injury, but the therapy and the results from it are often a lot slower, and the time taken for the therapy to be effective is generally much greater than people would expect, and often there are questions about whether it's appropriate from a cost-benefit analysis to use this form of therapy. But it can be effective. Again, same modifications, giving people notes about what has been said and getting them to keep a diary so that they can remember what they want to talk about and what you say to them in their sessions. I mentioned in the beginning about the management that apart from managing the person with the brain injury, what we need to do is manage the environment, and we need to address family issues. One of the problems that you can have with a person who's had a traumatic brain injury is to just view the person with the brain injury in isolation. And when you then look at the person with a brain injury and a psychiatric illness, it's even more important not to see that person in isolation. You need to manage the family, you need to manage the environment. And some of the things that are very important is to look at issues such as the education, to explain to the family why the person has the mood disorder, what the implications are, how it might affect their behaviour generally, but how it might affect their participation in rehabilitation. It's important to get the family to cooperate with the therapy that you're introducing. For example, I mentioned about taking notes, homework, diaries, ensuring compliance with medication, and getting the family to cooperate. They're really going to be you, the therapist, in the home environment, ensuring that the treatment you want the person to complete is actually happening. One of the things that's very commonly reported in carers of someone who's had a brain injury is the amount of burden that is placed on the carers. And there are very high rates of depression in carers. In the earlier table of the incidence of mood disorders, there was a paper by Lynn, and that paper was quite interesting because not only did they look at the rate of depression in people with a head injury, but they looked at the rate of depression for the carers of those same people. And they found that the rate of depression in carers was as high as the people with the traumatic brain injury. So the incidence of depressive symptoms was about 60% in carers. So sometimes what we actually need to do is we need to treat the carer's depressive illness to be able to manage the traumatic brain injured patient and their psychiatric illness as well. Now, some people would see that it's not appropriate to be treating two members of the family. You might need to refer the family member off to someone else. But sometimes, because of the whole complexity of taking care of someone, particularly with a severe brain injury, it may actually be more appropriate to be treating both members of the family at the same time and maximising the outcome. And finally, we need to deal with the expressed emotion within the family. Expressed emotion can be both positive and negative. Negative expressed emotion is where family members are very critical of the person who is identified as the patient. And positive expressed emotion is where they have very high expectations. What expressed emotion does, though, is it maintains psychiatric illness and it, in fact, can precipitate relapse. So if you have a family environment where there is a high amount of expressed emotion, positive or negative, that needs to be managed with family sessions to try and reduce it, because ultimately what you want to do is maximise the outcome for the patient. There are a whole number of challenges with the management or treatment of people who've had a brain injury. And in this slide, I've listed just some of the treatment challenges that occur. If we look at a patient population of people who've had traumatic brain injury, there are high rates of unemployment. If the person is employed when they have the brain injury, there is an increased rate of returning to work. But if a person is unemployed when they have the brain injury, their chances of returning to work are in fact very low. We know that unemployment in its own right is associated with an increased rate of mood disorders. So we've got a group of people who are injured, they're unable to return to work, and that infers a risk of depression. And then they might have an injury in, say, the left front of the brain that increases their risk of depression again. So obviously we have a challenge. We can manage the medical part of their mood disorder, but what are we going to do about their chronic unemployment? And we need to think beyond the management of just the person and to look at how we can address some of these challenges. Social isolation and restricted peer networks is another significant challenge for the treating practitioner. If we look at a group of people who've had a brain injury and follow them over 12 months, 5 years, 10 years and 15 years, what we see is over time an increasing restriction of their social networks. So ultimately, the only social network the person has is their family. And sometimes they even lose their family because the family just can't cope with the behavioural changes associated with the brain injury. Social isolation, restricted peer networks in itself can cause depressive illness. And so this can be a barrier for the person responding to treatment because they really have no other avenue to deal with their situation. They have no other means of social support. And the antidepressant and the cognitive behaviour therapy may not seem effective because we aren't dealing with these external challenges. Finally, I've mentioned the family burden and family carer issues in the previous slide, but probably one of the most important areas about treatment challenges is the issue about substance abuse. Comorbid substance abuse is actually very high, particularly in young head injured people. Cannabis in itself and significant cannabis use can cause a depressive mood state, and chronic alcohol use can also cause depressive illnesses. One of the ironies is that many men, particularly when they become depressed, start to drink increasing quantities of alcohol. So they drink the alcohol to treat their mood symptoms. The increased alcohol content causes them to be more depressed. And substance abuse is a significant problem for our unemployed, socially isolated, brain-injured people. And this needs to be addressed if we're going to achieve effective management for their mood disorders. So what happens to people who develop a mood disorder following a brain injury? Well, there are in fact no outcome studies that look at what happens if you treat someone with a mood disorder following a brain injury. There are outcome studies monitoring what happens to their mood disorders if they're not treated, and what we know is that the symptoms persist and that there is a relative stability of their depressive illness over time. So the mood disorder does not go away. In my patient practice, I have managed a number of people who developed mood disorders after their brain injury, and typically what I see is that I can achieve symptom resolution with appropriate therapy, but when we attempt to stop the antidepressant therapy, that the mood disorder returns. And so they're requiring ongoing or indefinite antidepressant therapy. Sometimes their mood disorder seems to become more difficult to treat as time progresses, and I think that's because a whole number of social issues start to impinge. For example, you know, they get to a stage where rehabilitation services withdraw, they don't have any kind of work, and they recognise the fatality of their persistent complaints. You know, they know they're not going to get any better, and they then seem to develop a psychological component to their mood disorder that requires extra therapy. But typically you can manage them quite effectively, and they do quite well with antidepressant therapy over the longer term. Obviously, one of the things we don't want to have happen to people who've had a brain injury is for them to complete suicide. And about 15% of head injured people will complete suicide if you look at a number of suicides over about 30 years. So it's quite a high risk of completed suicide, and it's probably one of the outcomes we want to try and prevent with appropriate identification and management. So mood disorders, I've demonstrated, is quite a common problem following traumatic brain injury. Depending on how you measure it, between 10 to 70% of people with a significant brain injury will develop a mood disorder. And this mood disorder is caused by a complex interaction of biological, psychological and social factors, and it's the interaction of these factors that ultimately leads to the emergence of the mood disorder. Multiple therapies will be effective in the treatment of the mood disorders, but we need to do more work in trying to deal with some of the secondary aspects of traumatic brain injury, particularly the changes in social and occupational functioning, to more effectively manage mood disorders in the future.